It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, we'll be taking your calls on whether homeowners should be able to sue wind farms for health risks like headaches, sleeping problems, and more.
First, though, we're going to take a look at one economist's unique approach to immigration reform.
Earlier this year, the U.S. Senate passed a comprehensive immigration bill, but it's not a sure thing in the House of Representatives. While many immigration reform advocates support that legislation, our next guest says states might be better equipped to handle the issue themselves.
Jagdish Bhagwati is a senior fellow for international economics at the Council on Foreign Relations and professor of economics, law, and international affairs at Columbia University. His article in Foreign Affairs is called A Kinder, Gentler Immigration Policy. Jagdish, thank you for joining us on Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. It's a pleasure.
So there's this question mark hovering over immigration reform right now in America, but you're kind of saying, even if this passes, this is not the fix-all we want it to be. Why do you say that?
Oh, I know. It's just provocative, but I think it's a valid thing. I'd said that when the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act had been passed, and it's more of the same. It didn't really work out, as you know, which is why we've got another major effort at the same thing. And the main problem is that we have a right-brain, left-brain problem when we try and do things at the Washington level. The left brain tells us that these are immigrants, and therefore we ought to treat them kindly and humanely and so on, and we ought to welcome them because, after all, we are a country of immigration. And the right brain says, look, but they are illegal immigrants, therefore they've broken the laws, and we are a nation of laws. And so we have almost a schizophrenic or bipolar disorder on the issue, but so usually divided between political parties. And to try and arrive at what I call a top-down approach, a reform like the one we are planning right now, like in 1986, that runs into the problem that in order to get any kind of progress made on immigration reform at Washington level requires making enormous compromises. Most Democrats, like me, have been in favor of the left-brain approach and trying to be humane and so on. But in order to get the legislation passed, you've got to make endless amounts of concessions to the opponents, you know, who believe in the right-brain approach. And when we start doing that, we're actually not really effectively regaining control of the border because, you know, ever since the 86 reform, the number of immigrants, illegal immigrants in stock, the stock has changed, it's become worse. The illegal inflow continues, though in a very, non-humane fashion, with people crossing the desert and so on and dying there and people being deported, et cetera.
Well, you're sort of making the case for a lose-lose scenario with immigration reform. Sounds like you're trying to please both masters, you please nobody. Is there a case to be made that immigration reform might, actually be a losing prospect for everybody?
I think the way, if we handle it in Washington, that's what happens. I mean, the two great presidents we've had on the Democratic side, in recent years, President Clinton and President Obama, Clinton was the one who, after the 86 Act, actually militarized the border. You know, large numbers of helicopters, digging trenches, building fences, even, the military military terms were used, like operation, operation this and operation that, and it didn't really gain anything except make life miserable for people who were trying to cross the border, and we didn't really get any reform again, until right now, in terms of getting people to collaborate. Then President Obama, if you look at his record on deportations, it's the worst ever. It's twice as many per year as even George W. Bush. So we've been making concessions to all kinds of people and saying, making amnesty very difficult to achieve with all kinds of restrictions and so on. We've said we're going to do increase enforcement expenditures by over $30 billion, all kinds of restraints like that. So, and in the end, it doesn't make any difference. to the influx. So I think we need a radically different approach.
Well, what should we be focusing on instead? If this isn't going to work, what is the path?
Yes, I think, let me be clear that, you know, we will help some people, but what it's not going to do is just give you control over the border, meaning controlling the influx of illegals. They're going to be with us. So the line I use in the article is that as long as we have restrictions, which we have to have, because almost 3 billion Chinese and Indians, if you tap them on the shoulder, they're going to say, yes, I want to go to USA, and where is the plane, and where is the ticket, and where is the visa? So we are blessed and cursed with the fact that almost half the world wants to get in here. So we can't afford to bet the company and say we're going to dismantle restrictions. And as long as you have restrictions, you're going to have this problem that we're going to have continuous influx of illegals. So think of the Untouchables movie. No matter how many, you know, how many Al Capones you remove by sending in, how many, you know, feds, as long as there's prohibition, the trucks will keep coming in one way or the other across the border.
Well, you've got a pretty provocative idea, and that is that, you know, Washington should just bow out and let states compete to draw illegal immigrants to their state.
Yes,
how does that work?
And I think that would work because there's a lot of work we've done which shows that when, in fact, the bad states, as I would call them, you know, I probably would get lynched by the opponents of reform of immigration. But when the bad states like Alabama, Arizona pass tough restrictions at the local level on things like driver's licenses and a variety of, you know, related local level things, then people actually, the illegals move away and they come to better states like New York, and now California has also passed benign laws and so on. So they simply get away, or they don't even come across the border to these states, but go to the better states straight away. And there's a lot of evidence of that happening. But what that does is to put pressure on the business communities, because we all know that the illegal labor is required. And in the book that I'm writing, there's going to be a little cartoon at the, you know, which shows how people are trying to build a fence. And they can't build it because there's no illegal labor to be had. So it's a kind of, you know, it's a sort of strange situation where the business groups really need it. So as they start losing labor, they begin to put pressure. And then what we say in political discussions is that the equilibrium, political equilibrium, then begins to shift in favor of people who say, look, ease up. We need the labor. It'll go away, and we're going to be in deep trouble. And there's a lot of evidence that this is happening in places like Alabama, Arizona, etc., that people are bringing pressure to bear. So that leads then to the bad states to start easing up and be converging, you know, slowly but certainly.
Well, it's a complex thing, right? Because on the one hand, you know, you're saying that illegal immigrants are helpful to the business community.
Yes.
On the other hand, you've got groups who are saying immigrants, illegal immigrants, are taking our jobs and hurting our families. So, I mean, how do you decide?
I think that may be true at a time of deep recession. So I'm not saying this is a solution right now. But what I am saying is that we have to be careful about what we say. Like, I mean, if you say Americans are willing to take jobs, and that's a standard argument, and this is really preventing, you know, foreigners are coming and taking the jobs away, we also have to say at what price are we willing to work? I mean, if in my class at Columbia University, if somebody says, look, I will pay you money in order to clean up the, you know, the lecture room. And I say, look, I'm not going to do it at the wages which you're paying to the staff, you know, to the janitors, etc. But if you give me $200 just to clean it up, I'll cancel my appointment with the National Public Radio and do it. So the question is, at what price are we willing to to work and for these jobs. And I think generally you will find, and mind, I'm not talking about deep recession. So right, the past 2-3 years have been really bad, as you know, particularly in Wisconsin, you know, which is more progressive as a state. I mean, you see this concern over that. I think the leaving that out and getting back to some normalcy in our system, the economy is reviving, and if it gets, you know, keeps reviving, then my argument applies, which is that Americans generally would not want to work at prices which can be afforded, because my university, as I said, I would be willing to clean the my classroom, but can the university afford $200 for my pay? That's really the nub of the matter. So my view is that the businesses are going to work at this. It's not that we are exploiting labor or anything like that, because mm-hmm. in a democratic system where the unions can have a say in you know, in whatever is happening in the system, and all of us can go to the hustings and so on and vote in and out of people out of power, there is more flexibility, more give. And in my view, as business groups really begin to weigh in the bad states, they will say that, look, we do need the labor. We have a definite shortage because we can't afford to pay the kinds of monies which Americans would naturally demand.
Okay, and I think we've got to leave it there. Jagdish, thank you so much for joining us.
Right. Thank you so much.
I appreciate your time. We've been speaking with Jagdish Bhagwati with Columbia University.
Now we'll take a look at the headlines, then we'll be back with your calls on whether homeowners should be able to sue wind farms and utilities that operate them for health risks like headaches, trouble sleeping, other things neighbors have reported. You can call now at 800-642-1234. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.